Attention, this is not legal advice. If you are experiencing a legal emergency, contact an attorney or your local public defender's office.
The views expressed by our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of Gin and Justice.
Talk about justice.
Hey, I'm Justine.
And I'm Amanda.
Welcome to another episode of Gin and Justice. And you guys are like, what? Woo! But you guys just released an interview last week. Why are you doing another one this week? Oh, that's because we're going out of order. You're welcome. It's a great interview. You're going to be really excited about it. But
we're very excited about it. That's why you're getting it early.
Exactly. It's like Christmas. But before we get to that, I have a couple things in the news I want to talk about.
Oh, okay.
So first and foremost, we talk about on the show, justice that makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to applaud this judge in Ohio. Yes. So I'm going to put this article in the show notes in case you want to read the full details. But we talk about restorative justice, community justice, justice that makes sense on this show. And this Ohio judge did just that. So I don't know if you see a lot of these. I feel like I see a lot of these cases in Florida where people get mad that their food order is not correct. And then they like
lose their shit.
Throw the food at the people
or
that
like
work
climb
there.
In the fucking drive thru.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen some crazy
like
stuff.
That one dude who like threw an alligator through the drive thru window.
That's
here
so Florida.
In Florida.
Man.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we had a situation like this at a Chipotle in Ohio.
At a Chipotle?
Yep. So woman was upset, which is weird because they make it right there in front of you.
Right.
So it's odd that it would be messed up. Anyways, regardless, that part doesn't
matter. Unless you called it ahead. I don't know if that was the situation. Because you can do that there.
All right. Well, maybe that's what happened here. So Rosemary Hain, who is a 39-year-old woman from Ohio, was apparently upset about her Chipotle burrito bowl and threw it at one of the workers and like swore a bunch. This article that's going to be in the show notes is there's a link to like the video and the whole Reddit thread about it. I'm not going to get into any of that, but I guess she basically causes this whole ridiculous scene in Chipotle. So
did they run out of guacamole?
I have no idea. I feel like their guacamole always has some listeria recall.
I don't know. It's fucking delicious though.
Well, anyway, so on November 28th, Judge Timothy Gilligan of Parma Municipal Court in Ohio states, quote, "You didn't get your burrito bowl the way you like it, and this is how you respond. This is not Real Housewives of Parma. This behavior is not acceptable." I like that quote. It's nice. He then proceeded to sentence her. So he sentenced her to 180 days with 90 days suspended, or he offered her an alternative option to reduce her jail time and agreed that if she worked 20 hours per week at a fast food restaurant for 2 months, she could reduce her time to 60 days. And she accepted the counteroffer. And she's going to be working at a fast food restaurant.
Have fun, bitch.
So, you know, like that's, I think sometimes the restorative justice that we talk about here is like stand in someone else's shoes. So anyways, I just thought that was a funny, interesting article.
I think that's great.
I don't know if it's
rude to
legal
fucking fast
sentence.
Food workers.
Right. Well, just don't be rude.
Period.
Just don't be rude. Yeah.
Especially to people that are making your food.
Just doesn't make sense. So
that was a good one.
Yeah. So I had to share that. But even more important, you know how a couple months ago I was like bitching about these fentanyl tests?
Yes.
Okay, great. Which, by the way, they're still using here in Florida every day.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The NARC searchy tests. If you're practicing law or you are charged with a crime of possessing fentanyl and you know for sure you didn't possess fentanyl, fight that. Just kidding. That's not legal advice. But I have seen an overwhelming amount of the NARC searchy tests come back as false positive for fentanyl. And then when it actually gets into a lab, it's like, oh, actually it's not fentanyl. And we've seen them come back as like a variety of substances, like better testing. Yeah, literally. Like I just saw another attorney that was talking about how his client had like ivory soap in his trunk to something to do with the fandel. I guess that makes it not famous sweet.
Krispy Kreme donut glaze. That was methamphetamine or some shit.
Right. So New York State Inspector General released a report this week, and it goes into great detail about the New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision using these particular tests, which have resulted in disciplining more than 2,000 incarcerated individuals, which, by the way, that's New York Inspector General's wording, not mine, incarcerated individuals, which I think is nice.
That is nice.
They don't use inmates. I love that. More than 2,000 incarcerated individuals across the state based on unreliable evidence, aka these NARC searchy tests that are giving false fentanyl positives that turn out not to be fentanyl. The report goes on to say that in August of 2020, DOCCS notified the inspector general that the NARC2 test had inconsistent instructions, potentially causing false positive test results. So basically the instructions from that point on were that before any action is taken, they needed to send these tests out to labs to confirm. What they found was that people were being punished and basically having all sorts of disciplinary action taken against them based on just these NARC test results. And the inspector general is finding these tests were essentially unreliable. And now they are ordering DOCCS to take remedial actions, including reversing and expunging the disciplinary records of incarcerated individuals who had been sanctioned on such tests.
I was going to say, I wonder how many exonerations we're going to get from this.
Yeah. And so, and it sounds like it's basically people who are incarcerated. So they still drug test people who are incarcerated, or perhaps they're testing things that they believe are drugs that people have as contraband and are disciplining through that. Essentially, they found that the instructions provided by the NARC2 manufacturer were inconsistent, contradictory, and in some instances, inaccurate, and that the manufacturer failed to identify this issue or advise DOCCS as to the existence of revised or updated instructions. And then this was basically compiled with the DOCCS failing to kind of follow up with laboratory tests. So the New York State Inspector General Lucy Lang says, "Lack of integrity in the systems administered to New Yorkers behind bars implicates all of us. This investigation and the subsequent policy changes and record expungements represent one step closer to ensuring the level of integrity we should all expect and demand from the state." She continues, "Illicit drugs pose a serious threat to the safety and security of those who work and live in correctional settings. And while the detection and removal of these substances is imperative, it must be done with accuracy and fairness." So she goes on to talk about some of the steps they're taking to kind of hopefully this doesn't happen again. So it's interesting. There's a link to the whole, I will also put a link to this article, but there is a link to the full Office of the Inspector General report, which kind of goes through everything. But it was just one of those, I knew I was right moments.
Aha moment.
Yeah. Like, oh, I knew it. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting.
You've been saying it for a long time.
I have been. And it's interesting because part of the Inspector General in this report, part of their issue is that the manufacturer, NARC, it's funny that it's called that, right?
It is
didn't inform New York State that, like, hey, like, they, our tests are not, like, really that great, or here's some updated instructions. As far as I know, they also have not informed the agencies who use them here in Florida. So it'd be interesting now that this report is out, if perhaps maybe this falls into some sort of mandatory disclosure in court cases. So anyways, I had to share that because I saw that and I was like lit up and I knew. So sadly, it took over 2,000 people being sanctioned over the last couple of years. And some of those sanctions included solitary confinement, delays in parole eligibility, and suspension of family visitation, among other things. But wow. So yeah, so that's really unfortunate, but
yes, being accused of things that you didn't do is unfortunate.
It is. Speaking of, do you think we're going to get into an exoneration? We're not. We're not, but
even cooler,
we have the best surprise for you guys. For those of you who absolutely love our exoneration episodes.
Which, me too. It's my favorite.
Yes. So, and they are so much fun to research.
Mm-hmm.
So we credit every time the National Registry of Exonerations. This week we have for you Megan and Jessica from the National Registry of Exonerations to talk about the database and all of the work that goes on behind the scenes.
And it's really incredible work.
Yes, absolutely.
So impressive.
So much goes in behind the scenes. It's super important. And it's really important that we keep this registry going. So they're going to talk a little about it in the episode, but it's really important to, if you can, please go and donate to help this registry continue going, especially those who are practicing law and using mm-hmm. that data. If you are practicing law and you have not used that data, I highly encourage you to go to the database, because there's definitely
even some- if you aren't practicing law, highly encourage you to go to the database.
Yes. But if you are practicing yes. law, you can use that in your legal yes. briefs, motions. You can cite to all of the issues that come with wrongful convictions. And they have all of that right there, and it's all fact checked. And so there's so much that goes behind it. So definitely, if you are able to, please go and donate. Their website will be linked in the show notes, and they're going to talk
really
about
easy.
It.
It's really easy. The donate button's right at the top of the page.
So without further ado, we are so excited this week to bring you Megan and Jessica. All right, guys, we are super excited. We kind of hinted we were going to have a surprise this week, and this week we are here with Megan and Jessica from the National Registry of Exonerations that you guys must be super familiar with, because that is the resource we use for all of our exoneration episodes. So Megan Welcome. And Jessica, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
That was completely in sync. I love that.
we worked together a long time. Yeah.
And you guys both have pretty unique backgrounds, and I kind of want to get to both of you. So, Jessica, do you want to start in what is your relationship to the criminal justice system?
Oh, sure. Thanks for having us. I'm Absolutely. Currently the research scholar at the registry. I read all of the cases that come through each exoneration from both researchers. We code those cases aggressively according to our coding scheme. And I manage all the publications and external communications and website management for the registry.
It is such an impressive website.
Thank you. Thank you. That's very nice to hear. It's aged well, I think. You know, we hope people are able to use it and navigate it with some ease. There's so much information there. So we're happy every time we hear that people make their way to it. I'm a former public defender, so I started my law career in criminal defense. I'm in good company, I know, and I loved it. I loved every part of it. And of course, you know, that's very localized work. And now I'm studying some of the same issues on a national level, which is fascinating and horrifying.
Yeah.
And we love it. We do a lot with a little at the registry. We're incredibly protective of the data, of the stories, of every last fact in every single case. That's what's so great about the registry. Each case is in there equally coded, equally from the high profile homicide exonerations that you hear about on the front page all the way down to local drug busts. So it really is the repository and the authority, as you all have kindly attributed, and it's just we're really proud of the work we do, so we're excited to talk about it.
You should be. Yeah,
absolutely. And Megan, what is your relationship to the criminal justice system?
So mine's kind of a convoluted path to getting here, but after law school I worked in corporate law in Chicago, and
was at a big firm, and I just ultimately was not happy doing that at all, and had always been interested in criminal defense and also specifically in wrongful convictions. So when I moved to Michigan, I connected with an old professor of mine from Michigan Law School, Sam Gross, to try to talk to him about how I might make that kind of awkward pivot from corporate law to wrongful conviction work. So he had just recently started the registry and offered me an opportunity to do some research working for him. So that was back in, I think, 2016. So I started doing research and I just absolutely fell in love with it. And at that time, the registry just had cases from 1989 onward, which was the year of the first DNA-based exoneration and kind of the year we chose to start the main database. But we had a lot of documents and cases from before that. So I spent the next several years creating the pre-1989 registry there. And then by that point, I was all in with the registry. So I've just kind of gotten more and more involved. So now I'm here.
That is awesome. How do you guys find cases that are new if they're obviously like not headline news?
They come to us in sometimes unexpected ways. You know, obviously the headline news ones are easy snags. We have two aggressive hound researchers who are just sniffing them out. I mean, our senior researcher especially is just like an 8-day a weeker. So they do track all the Google alerts. But they also go through the online databases and dockets and do legal research search terms for cases that are overturned. And that's a wide net, right? That brings in a lot of cases that won't ultimately end up qualifying for the registry, but it's a nice pool to fish in. And they pull cases that way. We foster really positive relationships with professional exonerators, innocence workers, CIU attorneys. And through those relationships, we are given information about exonerations. We sometimes receive tips from members of the public. We have occasionally received tips from incarcerated persons who do end up having a case that qualifies for the registry. We find cases every year from 2 years ago, 5 years ago. We find unknown co-defendants who are also exonerated for cases that have already been in the registry. It's just, it's sort of one case at a time, and they come to us in all these different ways, but primarily through the exhaustive hunting of our researchers.
Yeah. Shout out to Maurice Posley and Ken Otterberg.
Big one.
Those names sound very familiar.
Wow.
So there's so much research into all of the different factors that contribute to exonerations. How do you exactly get that into the database and kind of decide, because some of them are multi-factors, how do you decide kind of what's the most pivotal factor in each case to kind of put it under? How do you use that data? I want to kind of get into those specifics about the data with the cases and the different factors that contribute to exonerations.
Every case, and you know this from practicing, every case is different. There's always a great hook. There's always something newly shocking. I mean, you would think doing this work that nothing would shock us. And every case that comes through is like, can you believe this?
Right.
So each case hook will end up being how we feature the case, maybe how we broadcast the case on our different channels. But the coding is the same for all cases. So if a coding variable would be coded yes, we code it yes. We don't necessarily narrowly focus on one aspect of the case from a coding perspective. We're capturing anything and everything that's there. Mm-hmm. What you see on the website is just our public-facing coding. Behind the scenes, we code hundreds of other variables, some subcategories of the variables that you see, things that you don't see. We code so many granular subcodes for official misconduct, recantations, false confessions, and other researchers and journalists and academics are sometimes getting that data from us, you know, on a case-by-case basis and using it for their research. Coding decisions about whether or not to assign a specific code to conduct that we read about in a case and a fact pattern, to me, is very analogous to case law, right? So, like, you have the language of the statute, and then we're trying to see whether this conduct fits the language of the statute, and that's how we get our case law. And in coding cases, we write a code and the rule and how it's meant to be applied. But a case will come through every week that has us back to the drawing board saying, was this exactly what this code intended to capture? And we have these very impassioned discussions over every little code, because each little piece of data feeds cumulatively into this sum that is what gives us our ratios and our figures and what we're able to disseminate, what we know about what the body of evidence, the body of this data looks like as a whole. Mm-hmm. So each case is, like I said, fully coded according to the scheme, and we're able to bunch each of those, you know, we're able to bunch cases in each category and then say something about that category, right? So if we want to say something about false confessions, what does that look like? You know, does that come after a certain amount of time in custody, a certain amount of time being interrogated? Does it come because they were offered inducements, or they were pressured, or they were threatened with criminal prosecution? We can gather all the cases that have those things in common and study them from that perspective. So it is in there. Cool. It is in there some that they become useful sometimes.
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll see one day we'll see Brandon Dassey in that category of false confessions and why they happen. And
right,
so that's a pretty iconic example. I mean, that's
I would
everybody knows that
suggest,
one.
Right, I would suggest that as a sort of a textbook example.
Right, and so right. important in terms of reaching a wide audience, and you know, it's just everybody's instinct to believe that they would never falsely confess. You know, obviously, right. and right. it happens so a frequently. Lot. So,
right.
yeah.
He's a sad case, yeah.
And please, too. We hear that same language about please. Now, even in 2020, well, I wouldn't plead anything I didn't do. And
yeah.
So I'm very
That's not
fascinated.
True.
Right. I as an ex-practitioner, I get really mm-hmm. excited about the plea cases sometimes. Because,
yeah.
you know, we know how cases resolve. We know the pressure put on defendants in a position to resolve their case. And so, I feel like we have all these plea cases that demonstrate, again, a body of mm-hmm. evidence that combats that false trope.
Yeah. I feel like those are the hardest cases to overturn, too, because they kind of have the highest bar mm-hmm. of, mm-hmm. okay, well, were you under the influence? Did you know all the circumstances surrounding the plea? Okay, you did. Okay, great. Well, then it stands.
Right.
And, you know, those are, I mean, Amanda's heard me talk so much about cases where, you know, I've seen people plea because if they don't, then on their other case that they, you know, do have against them, they're going to get all these enhancements. And, you know, it's always just really unfortunate mm-hmm. to kind of see, because you do see people plead to things that you generally think they are not guilty of. And,
right. And all the time you have prosecutors that'll offer a plea, and then if they don't want to take it, they're like, okay, well, it's off and we're going to trial and you'll get this, mm-hmm. you know? So.
Right. Yes.
What do they call
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I mean,
the trial tax or something.
The trial tax, right. Yes. Well, and there are jurisdictions
that they'll never admit to.
Right.
Right. There's, you know, there's jurisdictions that won't cooperate and engage in plea negotiations at all if you file a single motion to compel. Then it's yeah. all bets are off. We're not going to work mm-hmm. with you until the disposition. So,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And some mm-hmm. some policies I can see from the state attorney's point of view. However, from the defense attorney point of view, it's like very frustrating. You know, if you have attorneys, state attorneys who are in charge of like sex crimes or something, and they, you know, once you set depositions of the victims, they will no longer negotiate with you. And I can understand from their point of view why they would do that. But then I can also understand from our point of view why that is a completely frustrating process, because you have no idea essentially what that person's going to say at trial, and you have no idea really what you're looking at until you set those depositions. So some parts I can see, but it's also, yeah,
doesn't seem also fair.
Yes. So, but what do you guys see is, from, you know, all of the data you have, what is the most common cause or common causes of wrongful convictions?
So we list six contributing factors: false or misleading forensic evidence, false confession, mistaken witness identification, official misconduct, perjury or false accusation, and inadequate legal defense. So the, you know, we are coding a national sample. So we have to come up with language and terminology that can be applied to cases from everywhere, right? I mean, so, you know, inadequate legal defense, we would really call that ineffective assistance of counsel in Florida. But we have to sort of come up with these categories that we can slot cases in from everywhere. So I will, you know, send your listeners to the registry's homepage and check out what we do. And you can filter all of those columns by those contributing factors, you know, see the totals, all of the cases that are coded for those contributing factors are also coded by demographic, crime, sentence, all these other things that you can really narrow whatever it is your specific research interest is or whoever you're advocating is for. If they have a child sex case, you can look at all of our child sex cases. If, you know, you can search just by Kentucky or just by New York, and then play with the columns in those ways to come up with a sample set and a batch of cases that show you where those contributing factors are more prevalent or during different eras. I mean, you know, we have seen this big shift in false or misleading forensic evidence because the further you get, the further the exonerations get in time, the better the science has gotten. So, it depends on which sample set you're looking at. Mm-hmm. And you can get all of that information right off the front of the webpage.
Very cool.
Again, it is a very impressive website.
Thank yes. You. And thank the, you. We're proud of the stories too. Mm-hmm. You know, the data we hope is so helpful to practitioners and journalists and the public, but it's also each individual story, the guys you can tell when you read them, really every single story gets the same amount of attention and they mm-hmm. really try to do it justice.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we talked to John Huffington on the show and he thought it was good. So.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
I was going to say too, you have probably seen, but people might be interested that we focus on specific issues and such as race and wrongful convictions or, you know, official misconduct and how that plays in. And we'll really focus on particular topics like that for a year or more. And then, publish these reports that are all available on our website. So if people have particular areas of interest, I know specifically the race report has been really impactful mm-hmm. and been useful to a lot of practitioners and people in the Innocence Network and trying to, you know, prove what many of us already are very aware of in terms of how race plays a factor into this and everything else in the justice system. So, you know, I think that's also an interesting aspect of our website that people may mm-hmm. like Definitely. To check out.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting because there's a state attorney that I work with pretty often and she's pretty cool, but she was not aware of, she's been practicing maybe since the early 80s, and she was not aware of the frequency of exonerations. And so, of course, I was talking about our podcast and I was talking about the exoneration episodes, and which led me to talking about the website. And I was telling her how you can filter into the different categories, and she was seriously surprised by the official misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct. She was really floored by that data and how that was such a common cause for wrongful convictions. So it was interesting educating her about that because she comes from a very ethical kind of viewpoint. And so when I was telling her that, you know, some of the prosecutors, especially in the cases we see around wrongful convictions, are so focused on getting that conviction. And I know, Amanda, you just brought up John Huffington, but mm-hmm. the prosecutor in that case, for example, was so bent on getting that conviction that when the case was coming back for, you know, appeals and hearings on, you know, new evidence and all of that, that prosecutor stopped his retirement so he could make sure that he was like still like following John Huffington's case. So it was interesting. I was able to direct her to the website and kind of show her like all of the different ways that prosecutorial misconduct kind of plays into a lot of the wrongful convictions. So again, very handy tool. I could literally just go into the category and click on that specific section. I was like, yeah, these are all from prosecutorial misconduct. So she was flipping through a lot of the stories. So it was very cool.
That's really great to hear.
Yeah. I was just going to say, when you're practicing, it can be hard to see outside your bubble on both sides. Defense and state has a filing cabinet of hundreds of files. The years can tick by without you really understanding the system outside of the jurisdiction that you're practicing in. And that's not that, I don't think that that's anybody's fault. That's the nature of the work. Mm-hmm. And, but if you venture to the registry and you really explore it and you really look at what's happening outside of the only, you know, the one little jurisdiction that you're practicing in that is familiar to you, I think most people would have that same experience. I have that experience with every other case that comes through. You know, prosecutorial misconduct can be so egregious and so shocking, you know, committed by practitioners and professionals who are under the same ethical licensure that we all are, you know, mm-hmm. hiding evidence in serious violent crimes where, you know, the real perpetrator is within that community. It really can so boggle the mind. And so it excites me when I hear that, especially someone engaged in the work, especially at the trial level, finds the registry. It's never too late to find the registry.
It's part of why it's so important to us that it always be publicly accessible, because we want everybody to be able to cite to it in their briefs, and everyone, you know, the judge has the ability to look up, you know, these stats and see where they're coming from and see that there is a legitimate basis for it. And it's part of why we spend so much time, you know, debating these codes and vetting them, because we do sometimes have to kind of defend our position in various situations. And we want to have really thoughtfully, you know, looked at this from each angle with each case and believe in what we're saying about, you know, how we code each of them and classify them.
Yeah. And I know one of the issues that you guys are facing right now is funding. Up until this point, where were you guys getting funding to make sure that the registry was there and is what it is today?
Well, it's always been a little bit of a patchwork quilt to try and make ends meet. It's interesting because we are a 3-university project, but we do not get financial support from those schools. So it's a little bit misleading, I think, to people sometimes. We do get the wonderful expertise of our professors who are editors. We do get the wonderful IT support from U of M. Shout out to Rich and Alex. but we don't, you know, you would maybe expect that we would have a lot of financial backing, and that's not the case, unfortunately. So initially there was some university support when the project launched. And then since then we have had one, significant donor who supported a lot of our work, but they are also involved in other criminal justice reform efforts. And so they kind of, you know, spread their support, and that comes and goes. And, also our team has grown a bit because the research and the needs to keep the registry going at the same level required a couple additional people.
Mainly the Detective Guevara cases probably needed a whole new employee.
Yes, honestly. Yes, seriously. Instead, it's just a lot more time from the existing
employees. Like, we need a whole new employee for this guy.
Yeah. So it was not like we had one major funding source we lost. We've always been kind of piecing it together. And that's actually part of why I moved now from a research role to this executive director position, because, you know, our editors are also full-time professors and they're editing cases, and our researchers, as you can tell, are, you know, working day and night to track down these cases and then write them up and code them and all of that. And so there just wasn't the bandwidth to devote to fundraising. And so we're trying to focus on that now that our need has really grown. It's a work in progress, but.
Okay.
We are really happy with the response. The last Innocence Network conference that we attended in the spring was when we finally decided to let the cat out of the bag, that we were sort of having these fears and struggles about the sustainability of the registry, the longevity of the registry, how are we going to keep it in its current form, which is so accessible. Yeah. And the response was so positive. Everybody was so shocked to learn that that was the position that we were in, and mm-hmm. really reinforced this idea that this is a critical piece of infrastructure in this movement, and everyone on the ground is not going to be able to do the work that they do without it. And just having that momentum and that support from the network, I think has really sort of accelerated our morale and mm-hmm. Allowed us to shift and bring Megan on as executive director. She has done amazing things in a very short amount of time. So we're optimistic, but the need is still very much there. So visit the website, click the donate button.
I was going to say, too,
it's real easy.
Right at the top. It's a little bit tricky because when you have something like an innocence project or an innocence organization, it's a very compelling kind of one-line story. Like, we get innocent people out of prison, and who doesn't mm-hmm. want to be a part of that or give to that? And it is so right. important. Whereas part of the reason we're excited for opportunities like this to get the word out about the registry is that it's not something most people know about, and it takes a few minutes to explain it. And it's not, you know, it doesn't have that really super enticing, you know, 1 minute pitch, because it's more building the infrastructure for the innocence movement, and the innocence organizations rely on us in their briefs. And mm-hmm. it's also, you know, creating this compelling amount of data that people can draw from when they begin their briefs, when they're trying to say, you know, Black people are, you know, 13% of the population, but over 50% of the exonerated individuals. And so if you don't have numbers to right. explain the problem and understand the problem, and you don't have the data, then you really can't start to fix the problem.
Yeah.
And so Jess and I and the whole team were excited to try and expand the universe of people who know about what we do, and, you know, kind of help them to see the value in it and how really important it is, even though it's not quite as, you know, right down in the trenches in the same way as some yeah. of the other innocence organizations.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like that, usually like that behind the scenes work in any place is very important to what the frontline people do. And, mm-hmm. you know, people just don't tend to see the behind the scenes portion. So it's yeah. like the database is kind of the really important behind the scenes piece that a lot of people use and is so necessary. I mean, yeah. it's interesting because I want to say, until I went to your website, I, even as a criminal defense attorney, I remember being in law school, and it was not taught that like innocent people were convicted. Like, it didn't seem like it was as big as a problem as it truly is. And then I remember one of my first couple years of practicing, I went to like a criminal defense attorney conference, and Jared, I can't think of his last name right now. He's like a really famous lawyer now. And he wrote the book that I just read. Well, that doesn't help narrow it down at all. Amanda, that book I was telling you that I absolutely love, Redeemed, Justice Redeemed, or Redeeming Justice.
That sounds
now
right.
Now I have to Google his name because it's going to drive me
I'm looking at
nuts.
My stack of books. Let's see, have I gotten it? No.
It's a really good book. I read it in like, okay, oh, sorry, Jarrett
Is it
Adams.
Jarrett?
Yeah. Jarrett oh, okay. Adams. I can't believe I just messed up his name. But anyways, he spoke at this conference. He told his story, and I was like horrified. Like that he was in prison for, I think, 10 years before he was ultimately exonerated. And he talked about, you know, going from the jail and then going to prison and being in Cook County and, you know, everything he had went through. And it was like, I was absolutely floored. And I want to say that was maybe my like second or third year as an attorney. And I was like, wow, this guy's story is absolutely incredible. And it was really kind of the first innocent story that I had heard, which is really sad. I had been an attorney for like multiple years at that point doing criminal defense. So like the fact that that was the first, you know, true innocence story that I had heard is alarming. I feel like it's something they should teach in law school.
Yeah.
And then fast forward a few years, and Amanda and I start this podcast, and initially we were not doing the exoneration episodes. It was just something we would kind of do here and there. And we covered a couple of really good stories that had popped up in the news and whatnot. And then it just kind of became a monthly thing because it was so many people. And going to your website was where we found the amount of people that have been exonerated since 1989. And it's so insane.
Mind blowing.
It's so insane. And so your website really was able to put a number for me, because I obviously knew it was a big problem, but I didn't know how big of a problem it was until I was able to see your website and see, oh, at the time it was like 2,000 something people had been exonerated. Now it's over 3,000, but which is how much it's grown just since we've been doing the exoneration episodes. But
right.
So it is such an important piece of data that I think is so necessary for not just people practicing law, but people who are just out in the world, people who are going to serve on juries, people who have served on juries, you know, so people who are going to vote in elections. You know, it's very, very important to kind of have that picture of the criminal justice system that is often missing.
Absolutely. And, you know, even if it just reaches somebody who brings it up at Thanksgiving dinner, you know, things disseminate. And that's how, I mean, I can remember exactly what you're talking about, Justine. Wrongful convictions weren't even part of our practice. It wasn't part of plea negotiations. There never seemed to be even a consensus that this was a risk, this is real. It wasn't part of anything that we were talking about, the state and the defense, or even with our clients, or even with our supervisors, or even in our training. And that's where we need to get, right? We need to get to a point where everyone understands this is very real. It is not inflated. That's why we take our credibility, the credibility of our storytelling, our fact checking, and our coding so seriously. We want policymakers paying attention. We want them to find it credible, which is why we code conservatively. We scan for inclusion conservatively. We decide things by the fire, by drum circle. We bring all of our very busy, very talented, very multitasking, brilliant editors into these conversations, sometimes about the smallest subcode that isn't even going to see the light of day unless a very narrowly tailored researcher who's looking at that exact thing asks for it. But they stop what they're doing and they engage every single time, because we want it to be as error-proof as it possibly can be. You know, we're going to have 3,500 exonerations by next year. So there is a margin of error in any storytelling. But what the public doesn't really understand yet is this doesn't exist elsewhere. You can't Google this body of evidence. These source documents have been hunted out through phone calls to county clerks and public records requests and assembled in this body that bears witness to this. And it doesn't exist elsewhere. Really almost nowhere else in the world. I mean, we've even looked at some international registries who are doing amazing things. And, you know, we've heard that they have modeled some of what they're doing after we're doing. But globally, nothing exactly like this exists. And, you know, as the stewards of that, we're very protective of it. And we want it out there. We want everybody to know what it is, everybody to trust it, and everybody to be sharing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. We do too.
Speaking of all of the hard work that goes in all of that, Megan, you had mentioned putting together a pre-1989 database. How difficult was that to get that information?
So I loved that project, and it's just maybe very dorky to admit, but it was so interesting going through these old newspapers and trying to find the stories. And thank goodness I was doing it in the era of digitized, you know, old newspapers. I don't know what you would do otherwise, but there have been probably four, you know, mostly professors or scholars over the years who had written books where they would collect examples of this. And, you know, it never got the same type of legitimacy or attention before DNA really changed how people viewed it. But there definitely was, you know, always some preeminent person who, you know, would study this. So I got all those books and went through those people. And there had also been, when the registry originally started, it was a joint project of Michigan Law School and the Center of Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern. And so a couple of the people at Northwestern, Rob Warden and Dolores Kennedy, had collected some source documents on old cases. So we had some of those files. So it was just kind of like a big mishmash of all of this. And so our coding scheme for the older cases is more limited because there just aren't as many details available or, right. you know, there often aren't court documents or that kind of thing. So drawing out exactly, you know, the more nuanced information wasn't feasible, but they're so fascinating. And it's really interesting to look over time at the trends. And we do have a report from when we published it that talks about, you know, what we found in the older cases, but also since the time we first launched that database in 2018, we've added almost 100 more to it, which for the old cases, that's a large portion of the sample. I think there are like 450 or something like that in the, or a little more than that. But that, you know, there used to be these cases that were so crazy. Like a person would be convicted of murder, about to be like hung in the town square, you know, and the person they murdered was their wife. And then like the wife comes like riding up on a horse and she's like, oh no, I wasn't dead. Like I was mad at him. So I went to stay with my mom like seven towns over. And like, you know, this blood was actually like cow blood or whatever, but the speed with which they would just like execute you back, you know, in the 1800s was no joke. And so, you know, there are more than five cases in there of people who were convicted of murder. And then the victim was actually found to be alive and just in a different place. So
insane.
I guess in the scheme of things, it's slightly heartening to see that we've improved somewhat in terms of the process and the, you know, that kind of thing. But they're from a historical perspective, they're really interesting and there are some pretty crazy ones in there. So it's worth checking out if you're interested.
That reminds me of, I'm reading a historical, it's not historical fiction, it's like a historical account of the Salem witch trials. And it was written by the author who wrote Cleopatra. So she's very good at really putting you in the time period. And you can see how these essentially false convictions came of these people who were accused of witchcraft and how quickly they hung them as well. So also very historical. And this was pre Bill of Rights. We didn't really have trial rights at that time period. And so essentially these like little teenage girls were just accusing people of witchcraft. And that is what led to all of these people, men and women, being accused of witchcraft. And once the little girl would accuse them, they were basically dragged into like the town tavern or the town hall, and they would be cross-examined by the pastor or, you know, the former pastor. And, you know, if they, any little thing would lead them to conviction of witchcraft. So it was pretty insane. So I can see how in the 1800s that we probably wouldn't be that far off from that. So that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. But it's nice because we, you know, used to kind of say we are a collection of every known wrongful or every known exoneration since 1989. And now, you know, we feel, even though there's not quite as much data in the main database that you would search for kind of, you know, pulling data sets and that kind of thing does begin in 1989. We feel like we have pretty much every known exoneration in our country.
Yeah. I didn't actually know there was a database pre-1989. So now I have something to go look at after.
Yeah, we keep them separate because it has fewer variables and codes. So it kind of allows them to exist differently, but it's all there if you're ever wanting to check it out.
Yeah.
The photos alone are worth doing it for. So.
Oh, yeah. I'm definitely going to check it out after this.
No, those cases are some of the juiciest. And
definitely.
I mean, because they're pieces of history. I always say the registry is American history. It's an important part of American history. But the old cases especially, you know, I mean, they're just relics of the past. And when you're interested in the criminal justice system or wrongful convictions, these are sort of the very first ones that we know about. And what is amazing is, you know, Megan mentions that we have come a long way as far as like not setting execution dates 30 days from conviction. But you will also see things in modern contemporary cases that were happening in the 1800s and early 1900s. And So it's, you know, it's a catch 22 in that way.
Yeah.
But they are really, really fascinating. And you mentioned the Salem witch trials. You should look at the child sex hysteria cases in the registry. We have a tag for that.
Yes. So
when you're sorting the tag columns, that was, you know, that whole thing in the late 80s and late 1980s and 1990s. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, when you read those cases, it's reminiscent of the Salem witch trials, which was just, you know, you look back on it, you're reading it now, these outrageous claims.
Honestly, when I'm talking to people about sex cases, period, I feel like there's some sort of hysteria and like you can't even like talk to people about it because
this was sort of a localized wave of hysteria, this almost trend among young people who were making these outrageous claims of sexual abuse that, you know, now when you read it and you know it's a wrongful conviction, it's shocking that, mm-hmm. you know, that the response was what it was. But we had that happen in the Salem witch trials and then we had it happen in the 1990s. So mm-hmm. if we're not documenting these and reading these, then we're just going to, you know, hopefully in, you know, 70 years, we're not doing, you know, still doing these things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there any cases that keep you up at night?
In what way?
In any way.
Sure. Yeah. You know, it never fails that I have two young kids and it never fails that when I'm having a particularly stressful or hard day, one of the guys will send me just a vicious like child victim case or, you know, a pretty vanilla crime, but it's just this 16-year-old black kid that got plucked off the street from his life, from his mother, right? Like we've seen it, but it's just mm-hmm. when you're reading about it in hindsight and you know that the end of the story is that he's 57 years old when he gets out of prison. It's yes, it still keeps me up at night. It still shocks me when I read a story of a lieutenant that I am familiar with because I have been studying his cases for years now. But every time I read of a new exoneree who got marched into that interrogation room and was hooked up to an electronic shock device to get a false confession, I have to run downstairs and talk about it. And, you know, it's the shock value will always be there and it should always be there because the heinous way that law enforcement can treat detainees and members of our community, of our country, is something that we should all, I would hope, take an interest in. You know, this sort of is, they say the proof is in the pudding, right? This sort of is that mm-hmm. It's demonstrable proof of things that, you know, in rhetoric and in policy arguments, there's this sort of pervasive denial that it even exists. And, you know, that's not doing any justice to those who have suffered under that. So especially the young kids and the false confessions and the abuse in the interrogation rooms. Mm. I think those cases really are the ones that still keep me up and just still
get. There's been times that I've had to like walk away from it for a minute because it like makes me that upset.
This is actually a place, too, though, where we can highlight some positive change that the registry has been a part of with regard to the juvenile interrogations. Do you want to talk about it, Jess, the statutory changes or?
No, go ahead.
Oh, well, just that, you know, I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, just the average person may not realize that in an interrogation, the police can lie to them about what their friend's saying in the next room or what evidence they have against them. Right. And, you know, that's scary enough to be up against as an adult, but that was also permitted for juvenile offenders or potential offenders. So the registry's data was, you know, very important in these new statutes that have been adopted in a handful of states now and seem to be catching on that, you know, ban this type of misleading or, you know, false information being a part of police interrogation. So we feel really proud and excited when there is like a substantive reform that pulls from our data because, you know, those type of changes are, you know, really what we...
Why you're doing it.
Yes, what we're working for and what we dream of happening on a lot of fronts. So that feels really good. And, you know, in those situations that you're all talking about where it just feels like so heartbreaking and you're pounding your head into the wall, it's really uplifting to see situations where it is making a change for the better. And I also wanted to say on the individual cases that that's part of why we feel it's so important to fully tell each story on the website, because, you know, it goes hand in hand with all the data, but truly each story, you know, is a human life and it's so heartbreaking.
And their family, what each
person went through. Right. Exactly. The just, you know, effect. Exactly. And when I was in law school, one of the, you know, older exonerees, Kirk Bloodsworth, came and spoke to us. And that was really what got me very, like, that day I was like, this is what I want to do. And then, like, you know, it was a convoluted path, but it was so moving. And I feel that way every time I hear an exoneree speak. And, you know, it's really just important to know that each story on there, each of these, you know, 3,500 stories is really a compelling and heartbreaking narrative. And so you can just kind of pull up any one. And we get emails too, like many, many, many emails to the registry from people who think that we may represent people who are currently incarcerated or, you know, may be able to do something to help them. And it's always, you know, it's really heartbreaking as we write each of them back and say, you know, we study this data after exonerations, but here are innocence projects, that kind of thing. But, you know, you just, you know what a long road it is. And so when I see these changes that prevent people from being in these horrible situations, where even if you're exonerated, it's, you know, better than staying in prison, but it's still pretty bad. You know, these changes that can hopefully prevent these terrible situations from happening are really giving us a little bit of hope in this challenging situation.
You mentioned the families, and I know that Maurice and Ken don't just chronicle what happens in the criminal event, but they also tell any information that we have about the person's family or circumstances. And you read often in the registry that at the time the exoneree was convicted, they had a 6-month-old child, a 10-month-old child, a 2-year-old at home, a 5-year-old at home. And then there are so many times where I go to post the case and the picture that is provided is them with their adult child. And of course, I'm immediately thinking of that 6-month-old baby.
Their grandchild is in the picture now. Yeah.
That never met that person outside of those walls for 20, 30 years. I mean, it's not just one human being that's affected. It's these whole communities.
And the whole story, it's like the parents who mortgage their house and the, you know, sibling who, you know, spends their nights working this extra job to try to pay for a defense attorney. And then that person, you know, just basically like doesn't, you know, provide the level of representation they need. So it's just so many aspects of it that contribute. And it's just really important that we kind of, you know, at least make sure that that story is available and known and memorialized.
For all the parties, not just the exoneree. I can't tell you how many cases we have in the registry where the prosecuting attorney, perhaps someone that we've coded official misconduct for, now sits on a bench. So we want sunlight on, you know, not just the exoneree by name, but all the parties involved in this wrong.
And then also instances where the prosecutor supports the, you know, I've seen those too, where they look back and they support, you know, the efforts for exoneration. So it's important to acknowledge all the different ways that it plays out and the ways that people contribute or don't. And, you know, we're seeing more conviction integrity units pop up. And we like to feel like we're a part of, you know, that movement as well. So
I used to always say there needs to be a drug court in every jurisdiction. And now I say there needs to be a drug court in every jurisdiction and also a CIU in every jurisdiction.
Right. A legitimate CIU.
It's interesting too, because I, you know, talking about the effects on exonerees and their families, I follow Amanda Knox on some of her social media, and it's really heartbreaking because she was exonerated and people still think she is guilty and harass her daily. And so, you know, I think that's another, this is another reason why I love the way you guys cover these stories, because they're so detailed. You see where things went wrong. You see where, you know, you don't ever read a single one and go, oh, but maybe they did do it. You know, there's no room for, of course, people are going to think what they want, but I love the full coverage of each story because you can see every point where it went wrong and, you know, all the efforts that it does take to kind of come back from a wrongful conviction. It's not an easy road. The road to convict, you know, is a slow one. The criminal justice system is pretty slow when cases are, you know, vetted out correctly, but then even more so when you are trying to overturn a wrongful conviction. It's like an incredible amount of time and effort and letdowns. So, yeah.
And so, again, it's not easy and it's not quick and it's not where it should be, but there has been a lot of positive progress in the world of compensation. Yes. Like if you look at these pre-1989
those are the ones that make me happy.
Like you're lucky if you get a, I'm sorry. Yeah. And so, you know, it's not like where it should be, but, it is, you know, it used to be almost impossible to get any. Yeah. And so there's some forward movement in that. And that's, you know, something we also.
Honestly, it's like the least we could do here.
Right.
Make them filthy rich until they die.
Yeah. And, you know, for those who are.
They shouldn't have to want for anything is all I'm saying.
Right. But also, you know, that's an additional, you know, it's less significant than the human loss and all of that, but it costs a lot of money, these wrongful convictions. So for the people who are focused on that aspect of things, like it's not cheap for the state to, you know, wrongfully convict people, have people they shouldn't have in prison, have crimes continued to be committed by, you know, if it's a situation where there was a crime and a real perpetrator, and then, you know, potentially pay out, which they should be doing, but, you know, there's a lot of factors about it. So if we can, you know, reduce the number of times this happens, it's good on many different levels, not just the most significant, which is the human loss.
Right.
And we don't make judgments on guilt or innocence at the registry. We aren't in a position to do so. We have pretty strict academic protocols with our UCI affiliation. So we follow the official actions of the government bodies, either the exonerating court or the pardoning member of the executive branch. So because we do occasionally get feedback. I would say it's pretty rare, but we do get feedback from folks who didn't meet our criteria and are wondering why, or folks who, like you said, are still convinced that someone who's in the registry is factually guilty. And our response to that is earnest, and just that we aren't making a judgment call. We don't decide who comes into the registry. If they have been formally legally exonerated in a way that qualifies them for inclusion, then they're in the registry.
Right.
So it is, we try to be as objective and conservative as we can in our inclusion and in our coding so that we can say that this proxy, right? This sample of cases is a proxy for the whole system, is the floor. There's nothing that's overcoded here. There's nothing that we let in, but we weren't sure. Like our inclusion criteria is rigorous, and it is such so that we can be confident that this sample, this proxy, is an absolute floor. And it's horrible at what it is, right? It's like, even at the floor, this is horrible. But imagine what the scope of the entire problem really is.
Sure.
Yeah, definitely. Interesting. I know that we are running out of time. I ask everybody, if our listeners could take one thing away from this interview, what would you like it to be?
It's a hard question.
Like, I've got 20 things popping in my mind right now. You know, I think there's just the reality that wrongful convictions are happening on an ongoing basis. And I think every jury is made up of members of the public, and probably none of us will get to be on one because of our background. Yeah. It's my dream, but I doubt it. Know, everyone who's listening, I think it's just the best thing you can take away is that if you're on a jury go into it knowing that these wrongful convictions happen all the time, and just, you know, be aware of that and don't try to get out of jury duty and go do a good job of keeping this in mind and all the things that go on behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And then also, if you're looking for a 501c3 charitable organization to support, please consider the registry.
Yes,
definitely.
Thank you so much for having us on. We're so excited. We love your show, especially the exoneration episodes. And
Thank you.
The support you show to us and Maurice and Ken. It's really deeply appreciated, and all your good work. Thank you so much.
Well, we deeply appreciate you guys.
We appreciate the support and the kind words. You know, I just want people to visit the registry website. Everything is there. Use the interactive graphics and the tools, fish around. There's some really fascinating information there. And it's, you know, I think that it paints a really grim and a really optimistic picture of the legal system at the same time. It shows what we are capable of. It shows what progressive prosecutors and good post-conviction appellate attorneys and, you know, good investigators and sound decision-making by the judiciary can do and is doing. And it shows the darkest corners of sort of a central fixture of our Constitution. And we all as citizens have a responsibility to know that this is happening and to read the human stories and see what is happening to American citizens that are funneled through a legal system that has so much potential, but is so deeply flawed.
And an easy way to get there, rather than the long Law UMich link, is exonerationregistry.org. So that's an easy way to check it out. It's kind of hard otherwise to link to. So,
we'll plug
it in the show notes too. So,
thank you. Yeah, I know, it makes it easier. And There's a lot of interesting stuff on there. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it. If there's ever anything that you guys need,
I mean, if there's ever any question you have, if there's something that we may have that is not on the website, please do not hesitate. We love doing that. Never hesitate.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right, guys. We will see you guys next time on Gin and Justice.
All editing for Gin and Justice done by Gin and Justice Podcast.
Artwork by Justin Cardone. Photography by Kimber Schwakey.
We'll see you next time on Gin and Justice.